The Cave. Strategic Air Command's old headquarters at Offutt Air Force Base has seen better and worse days. Better when it was a buzzing hive of planes and blue uniforms, jet exhaust in the air, and the camaraderie of those who know that they're the best in the world at what they do. Worse in the summer of 22, when the nukes came, thundering blossoms of thermonuclear heat that reshaped the landscape. The nukes turned sand to glass and flattened anything that wasn't built to bunker specifications in a hurricane of wind, pushing first out from the blast and then rushing back toward the mushroom clouds of the MIRV warheads. Now, some of the great hangars have been rebuilt, SAC's old underground catacombs reoccupied. A new general commands, with men in strange uniforms. The swastika flag flies, its spiderish black and white design stark and forbidding against the blue of Omaha's skies. 36 hours after the bonfires died, Valentine, Anka, and a strong young grog named Kizmem watched the shadows lengthen across the old base south of Bellevue. Anka selected Kizmem after the flame-lit night in the ghetto. Valentine remembered the rest of the revolt as little but a confused series of impressions. The twisted cross barracks aflame, screams of man and grog, the endless drumming, gunfire clattering in the distance, dying off, then starting up again. Fresh ash lifted skyward, turning the wind bitter. Valentine stayed out of the struggle at the request of his friend, who feared that in the confusion, some Golden One would shoot him down as one of their Twisted Cross overseers. The killing did not stop until after dawn, when the last guards in the watchtowers outside the walls either fled or were brought down by snipers. The towers inside the walls unexpectedly revealed major structural faults as the revolt got going, and they came crashing down at a signal of one of the Golden One engineers. The Golden Ones shot as far and as well as their gray brethren, many of whom lay dead in the upper floors of the Great Hall and in the little barrack houses outside the two gates of the ghetto. With a few hours' rest and some warm food inside him, Valentine decided to push on southward. He knew the Twisted Cross would not take the Golden One revolt lightly, and that they'd be back soon with everything the general had. Anka shared Valentine's fear of the coming threat and refused to be parted from him.
Anka, your people need you more than I do.
My David, here I am just one more set of hands. With you, I am half of the First Alliance joining Golden Ones with the Freeholders. Honored to stand at the side of a friend. In which role can I help my people more?
Valentine wanted to go to the General's cave and throw a little sand in the gears of the Twisted Cross war machine before it could return to Omaha and quash the Golden One rising. But now it would take more than blowing up a few hundred feet of bridge. In preparation, he and Anka liberated flamethrowers and explosives from the hall's armory. Kizmem made the pair a trio after Anka drafted him to serve as packhorse and guide. Anka assured Valentine that the young grog knew every corner of the above-ground part of the old Strategic Air Command base. Kizmem, in the full flush of his 20-something strength, shouldered the weight of flamethrower, satchel charges, food, as well as his own pistol and rifle. Anka carried the other flamethrower and a slightly lighter load. Valentine had an additional satchel full of grenades, white phosphorus incendiary grenades among the others. Anka examined one of the cylinders as they walked out of the ghetto.
With these, they burn the houses of those they would punish. I should like to give the Hooded Ones a sample of their own flame.
The cave was a little more than a long day's walk south of the ghetto, but Valentine did not want to move straight down the rails connecting the base with the city center. What was left of the Twisted Cross ghetto police had taken that route. Discarded equipment lay at the edge of the rail line like markers. They were probably holding some intermediary point, waiting for their own chance at vengeance. So the trio took off west before turning south, retrieving Valentine's submachine gun and pack from the little cache, picking its way south with Valentine scouting well ahead, sweeping the smuggler's trails of Omaha with his ears and nose. The party took its time. Valentine wished he had another few days to look for Duvalier. They weren't very far from the rendezvous point. The day had a hint of autumn to it. Even the afternoon heat had a cool quality to it that the summer days lacked. I spotted a scout plane midday. If the little ship was not the ill-omened red and white one from the dunes, it was its twin sister. It flew up from the south and circled the city above the Golden One ghetto. As they watched it from a halt, Valentine explained to Anka the story of its use in the dunes.
So that means that we'll attack soon.
Yes. They'll hit your people before the Golden Ones can get organized.
Our people, my David. Our people. From this day forward, you will always be accounted a member of our clan. And welcome in the hall.
I hope there'll be a hall. And people of yours to do the welcoming.
Valentine studied the little plane. At another break, in the roofless ruins of a warehouse, Anka showed Valentine how to use the flamethrower. It consisted of three tanks on a backpack frame, a small one with compressed air, and two larger tanks containing gasoline with a thickening agent. The mixture was fired by what amounted to a heavily built garden hose attached to a wide-mouthed insecticide sprayer. It fired the jellied gasoline a good 30 yards with a frightening roar of flame.
You know, I saw some burnt-out ruins in Wisconsin once where the Kurians had been doing some kind of training under the supervision of the Reapers. I wonder if they were teaching their men how to use these things. None of us could figure out how so much damage could be done without explosives.
You must be careful with your trigger finger, my David. This pack is half empty now. You must use very short bursts, and even then you have only a few. Why do we carry these all this way?
I want to do the same thing at the cave that I did at the hall, just on a bigger scale. The hooded ones are terrible, but the ones working them are vulnerable. Maybe more vulnerable than the general knows.
After a final hard march, they came up on the damaged areas outside the base in the late afternoon. The scouts shared a heartroot meal and a patch of tall grass at the old interstate, looking down at the outer edge of the camp. The perimeter fence consisted of two lines of fence topped with concertina wire. The main part of the base was hidden behind a lip of low hills, concrete observation bunkers set among them like teeth. A rail track ran along this, the western edge of the base. Kizmem pointed to the wire and the area beyond. Anka patted the youngster on the head and turned to Valentine.
Between the wires are mines. You cannot see them, but there are guard posts well concealed behind the wire. Not all are manned all the time. The general still does not have all the men he wants, but he has plans for this place. He trains new soldiers always. Omaha will start to be a good post to give recruits experience.
They got an experience, all right.
Valentine trailed his binoculars over the open prairie surrounding the base. It would be a nightmare to get in. There were probably tripwires within the concertina, if not Reapers prowling like guard dogs.
I don't think marching up to the gate is going to work for me here.
I told you, our people are resourceful. There is a small tunnel that stretches very far. It opens out on the far side of the old concrete road behind us. A few have used it to escape. We cannot go through it in great numbers, for the air goes bad within. Kishmem says it is very tiring. You have to crawl the whole way. It opens within the base in a livestock barn at the pigpen sluice.
Fantastic.
Valentine was not sure if Anka's knowledge of English extended as far as sarcasm.
No, my David. This is to your advantage. They use dogs on the base, some running free at night to find intruders. Pig odor may confuse them.
After the meal and rest, they swung around to the west in a final arc to the exit hole for the escape tunnel.
Strange how things turn out. We dug this to let our people get out, but we will use it to get in.
Not we. I don't think we should all go in, especially at night.
Anka opened his mouth to argue. The noise of engines caused the three to drop to the ground. Valentine and Anka climbed up to the cracked and uneven remains of the old expressway and looked out at the western border of the base. A column of trucks bumped along a road running alongside the rail line bordering the cave, turning out from the main gate that Valentine could now see farther to the south. A 4x4 scout car led the column, followed by a genuine armored car on fat tires. Then came truck after smoke-belching truck, 22 in all, mostly old 2.5-ton army jobs, restored and painted and towing trailers. A few of these carried machine guns mounted in a ring on the roof above the passenger seat. Double-axle pickup trucks towing cannon followed the army trucks, interspersed with camouflage-painted U-Hauls. In the beds of the pickups, uniformed figures sat facing each other. Valentine plucked a piece of grass and chewed it as the procession of motorized military might passed by.
I see some of our people still wish to serve the general.
Utility trucks rolled by, their slat-sided beds filled with armed golden ones and gray ones.
My species hasn't cornered the market on betrayal. There's good and bad everywhere.
I would have more good.
Anka lifted a mule's worth of gear.
Someday, old horse.
Valentine watched dust settle as the column bumped off to the north at a steady 10 miles an hour.
The sun is setting. The Twisted Cross Reapers will be in Omaha soon, and I have a tunnel to crawl through.
They went back to the outlet, an old cement drainage pipe by the interstate, broken open by some force of war or nature.
I believe you should let me come. Be another set of eyes, if nothing else.
Suppose we're crawling through your tunnels, a Reaper passes overhead. He might find it strange that Life Sign is passing a few feet under his boots, don't you think?
Valentine turned over the PPD and his remaining ammunition.
Here's my gun. If I'm not back by tomorrow morning, go to the meeting place at the river I told you about. There should be a human woman there. If not, look for a pile of four of anything. Rocks, firewood, whatever. There may be a note in there, and you can act on it as you see fit. Or go back to our people in Omaha.
He unwrapped his old nylon hammock, placed the flamethrower, his sword, and the satchel charge within its webbing, and then wrapped it all up in a blanket. He climbed into the tunnel, pulling the sack behind him.
See you at sunup.
Valentine backed into the hole. The escape tunnel was a wonder of improvised engineering. Valentine had expected to have to wiggle through it like a mole in a garden tunnel, but forgot about the grog shoulder span. Wood held it up in some places, corrugated aluminum in others, and beneath the road and rail line, Valentine crawled through a real concrete tunnel. The building of this thing must be a fascinating story in itself. He promised himself to hear the whole tale from Kizmem should he come out of this. It grew pitch dark as he left the opening behind. Valentine hated the abyss of absolute dark, the dark of the grave, of death. Even his newly sensitive eyes were useless. Only the Reapers could hunt here. He imagined steel-like fingers reaching out of the darkness behind him and closing around his neck. He reached into a pocket for a leather tobacco pouch and brought out the diamond-shaped glow bulb that Ryu gave him as a parting gift. He had bound it in a little harness loop of leather, which he now hung around his neck. The comforting yellow glow was like a tiny little piece of the sun with him in the darkness, and Valentine felt his fears shrink back to manageable size. He smelled a faint piggy aroma. Dragging the burden behind him was an exhausting process. He had to stop every 10 minutes to rest. He learned to do this under the two infrequent air tubes the grogs had poked through to the surface. Rats and field mice had taken up the tunnel as a convenient home. He smelled and heard them all around, even if he couldn't see them. With his back and shoulder muscles screaming, Valentine inched down the tunnel. It was kind of like rowing a boat, except for the absence of boat, fresh air, and water. He would scoot his buttocks a foot down the tube, which seemed to stretch endlessly through miles of midnight, then drag his improvised blanket sled along behind him with a pull at the non-existent oar. The piggy smell was his holy grail, his stink at the end of the tunnel. As it intensified to the point where he no longer needed his wolf's nose, he pulled with renewed energy. When he felt his probing hand come away smeared with filth, he knew he was at the end. He left the pack where it was. Fighting disgust, he smeared his face and hands with the soiled mud. He would have to remember to carry a can of Duvalier's grease paint from now on.
Telling yourself you're gonna survive this, huh? It's a one-way crawl, then you know it.
The tunnel bowed into an upward slope. Above, he saw a length of 10-inch pipe with a funnel at the end, running vertically through the tunnel. He put away his comforting light cube and let his eyes adjust. Hints of light could be seen around the edge of the funnel. He listened with hard ears. Valentine moved the funnel. The wide part covered a hole chipped in a concrete basin just below dirty grating apparently set on the floor above. The smelly sluice pipe and funnel came out of the ground easily enough. He climbed up through the hole in the bottom of the space just below the grate. He paused to listen again and then lifted the grate. He peered into the cement-floored pig pen of the barn. In one warm corner, a heap of porkers lay grunting in a pile. Across a low partition, he could see another pig pen and its cluster of sleeping livestock. He climbed out of the grating hole. One of the pigs woke up and gave him the once-over, but flopped back on its side when it saw he bore no slop pail. Valentine reconnoitered the lowest level of the unlit barn. It sounded and smelled as if cows were above on the main floor. The pigs shared the basement with a tractor and a horse trailer on blocks, now filled with chickens. He dropped back into the tunnel and began to transfer his equipment. He sensed a reaper roaming somewhere as an unsettling tickle at the edges of his mind. He lifted his arsenal out of the tunnel. The pigs took one look at the flamethrower and decided it looked like some new kind of trough-filling device and began to gather around and oink in excitement. Valentine escaped to the garage area, listening for sounds of investigation. He hid the satchel charge and flamethrower behind the tractor and climbed up a series of ladders to the hayloft. The smell of alfalfa and hay brought back a rush of memories of Molly and their first tryst. Keeping to the shadows, Valentine surveyed the land as best he could. The barn stood behind the apartments of the officers' residences. In the distance, he could see a concrete tower at the restored airfield. As far as he knew, the Twisted Cross Air Force consisted of a single two-seat scout plane, but perhaps the general had plans to increase his fleet in the future. A bunker-flanked hummock of ground marked the entrance to what Kizmem called the Cave, the nuclear blast-hardened headquarters of the Twisted Cross. The biggest above-ground structure on the post was the massive train hangar. Valentine could see the front of the building from the three-story high loft of the barn. Built on the concrete foundations of a hardened airplane hangar, a network of rail lines ran parallel across the wide area in front of it before turning toward the main gate. It reminded Valentine of pictures he saw of the German submarine pens in the Second World War. According to Kizmem, they were in the process of adding enormous steel doors running down tracks in the concrete columns that held up the reinforced roof. Valentine could see sparks thrown by welders even now in the dead of night as work proceeded on the multi-acre structure. They lit lines of boxcars inside, and Valentine could make out a few laboring figures within the machine shops and workbenches inside. Somewhere deep within the cave, a natural gas power plant supplied electricity for the entire base, including for the electrified perimeter fence he knew to be in the works. He moved over hay to the north end of the barn and watched the guards at the main gate. He wondered if the tracks were wired with explosives. If so, it might be feasible to assault the camp by running a train through the gate. More barracks stood behind the low ring of hills that sheltered the base from prying eyes, and two more looked like they were under construction. Valentine did not know if the hills were natural, man-made, or the remnants of crater rims caused by nuclear explosions in 22. A reaper lurked somewhere, near the entrance to the main gate. He sensed another near the cave, and possibly two near the hangar, though those last were at the edge of his range. Valentine forced himself to rest in the hayloft for 15 minutes. He was exhausted from the hike and the cramped crawl through the tunnel, and he needed to think now that he'd seen the hangar. He had a lot still to do this night. The rational part of him wanted to get back to Southern Command with what he had learned. Certainly, the Twisted Cross needed to be taken very seriously. Left untouched, the general would eventually have enough Reaper human pairs to consume the free territory. Teams of Twisted Cross could destroy the border posts and principal bases as easily as they'd destroyed the Denverites at Fort Rowling. Valentine knew Southern Command had some kind of emergency plan to fall back into the more rugged mountains. But how long could you feed hundreds of thousands of civilians in the hills? The Twisted Cross had weaknesses hidden behind their black and white flag of terror. This general, whoever he was, seemed still to be in the process of recruiting and building his army, testing it against easy targets as he trained more men. If Southern Command could be convinced, Ballantyne would guide as many bear teams as they could afford to send up here, and this general's all-conquering army might be stillborn in the act of creation. Ballantyne's mind kept returning to the Golden Ones, betrayed twice by Kerr, and now in full revolt. Perhaps there were other Grogs elsewhere, equally mistreated and exploited, who would follow in their footsteps if just shown the way. Given time and training, the Cats could... But the Golden Ones didn't have time. The attack was already being prepared, and Ballantyne knew that the Twisted Cross Reapers would hit the ghetto in the darkness. They'd go in to kill, not occupy, and leave daylight mopping up of any remaining strong points to the support troops. The threat to Southern Command might be years away. The Golden Ones would die tonight. If Ballantyne could use the demolition charge judiciously, the general might lose a few more of his precious Reapers. Just the act of debating his course was an admission of surrender in a way. If it was the fate of the Golden Ones against duty, duty would lose. A few minutes after midnight, Ballantyne lurked outside the train hangar. He had found a blue jumpsuit hung up in the barn and put it on, along with a pair of muddy rubber galoshes. He piled the sword, flamethrower, and satchel charge in a wheelbarrow, threw the blanket over them, and headed for the gate to the officer's compound. He wheeled it slowly and tiredly toward the gate, and the sentry stepped out of the shadows and into the light, shotgun under his arm, and collar turned up against the cool air.
Sorry, that took way longer than I thought. Turned out she had twin calves, and I just couldn't get the second out. I ended up having to pull it round by getting a piece of twine and drawing its head around.
It was the sum total of Valentine's calving knowledge in a single verbal broadside, but it got him 10 feet farther toward the guard.
Hold it now. Now!
Valentine's sword flashed. The guard fell over with a stunned look on his face, perhaps not believing that a human being could move that fast. Ballantyne put on the guard's jacket and hat and tossed the shotgun in the wheelbarrow. He left his weaponry in a shallow depression in the middle of a field near the mountainous building, covered it with the blanket, and began scouting the train hangar. He found a four-wheeled pushcart, piled it with a few items of scrap metal, and began to push it around the pavement, looking busy. Ballantyne counted 28 boxcars in three rows in the train hangar, with guards and dogs protecting the cargo within. None of the workers approached the guards any nearer than they absolutely had to. Ballantyne looked in the open side door of one and discovered that the ordinary-looking boxcars contained more of the metal coffins, perhaps each with a Twisted Cross soldier floating inside and animating one of their Reapers. Ballantyne let his hard ears roam, listening to the workers in the train hangar. The laborers were wondering what happened to the Golden One labor that usually was here to help them. Earlier that day, guards came through and collected the Golden Ones. They had been placed in a special compound. Some thought they were being searched for weapons. Others believed they had been taken as hostages to ensure the reliability of the general's puppet on the throne back in Omaha. There were rumors of a fight in the city. Then orders came through to strip the base of anyone who could be trusted to use a rifle properly.
The general's really lost it.
Though Ballantyne moved beyond the workers, his ears still picked up every disgruntled word.
First he tries to bite off more than he can chew out west and loses a big chunk of his best teams. And now it seems like there's a trouble in Omaha. Instead of letting it cool down, he always demands scorched earth. He can't win a war because he refuses to ever lose a battle. He always talks about how patient he is, but...
Watch it, you! I don't want to be put on a list because I was talking treason.
It's not treason to say there should be more carrot and less stick. I signed on to this for the carrot. A big stretch of land to call my own and a brass ring like my old man has. It's been 4 years of step and fetch and still no ring, no land.
I'd be happy if they just got the hairbacks working again. I'm breaking my back here.
The concrete control tower stood in the center of the hangar. It sat on a base that Ballantyne saw housed a spiral staircase, going down as well as up. The tower widened out to a bowl above, and four Twisted Cross soldiers stood atop it. Machine gun muzzles projected out over the edge of the bowl. Valentine pushed his cart past bunkers standing outside the hangar at the corners. The strong points didn't worry him. Their firing slits were designed to cover the approaches to the yard, not the interior. He looked across the cavernous interior, trying to figure out where the satchel charge might do the most good and how to deploy it. Valentine brought his cart outside again, ostensibly heading for the junk pile. When he returned, the weapons were still hidden in plain sight in the wheelbarrow. He put them on his scrap cart and pulled it toward the center of the train hangar. As he approached the whitewashed guard tower, a sentry stepped forward.
Just a sec, buddy. Where do you think you're going with that shit? Nothing's allowed to be stored by the cars, even temporarily.
Valentine kept pulling the cart and pointed across the yard to a line of workbenches against the far wall. The cart bumped over the last set of tracks, deeply recessed into the floor of the train hangar next to the tower, and an 8-foot-long metal rod rolled off his cart, helped by the tiniest nudge of his leg. The guard stepped around in front of him.
You want to get over there, dumbass? You go around. Just because the lieutenant ain't here doesn't mean I can't take your number.
Valentine picked up the steel rod and moved to put it back on the cart. Suddenly, the cat uncoiled his body, swinging up the rod and catching the guard under his armpit. Ribs and shoulder bones cracked. The guard's rifle flew away as its owner tumbled to the ground. The whistle blew from somewhere near the boxcars. Valentine pulled the cart to the door at the base of the tower and shouldered the flamethrower first, its nozzle clipped to the tanks. He put the satchel charge over the other arm and went up the spiral stairs with the shotgun in one hand and his sword in the other. A twisted cross guard was on the stairs above. Valentine put down the sword and heavy weapons. He bent and jumped up 5 full steps, turning in the air as he went. He fired the shotgun in the man's face, sending flesh and bone flying. Nearly at the top, he could see the ceiling above. Valentine pulled the pin on one of the concussion grenades.
1-1,000. 2-1,000.
He tossed it up into the balcony.
Grenade!
Valentine bolted down the stairs to his other weapons. Even with concrete and 2 loops of the metal staircase to protect him, Valentine still felt the blast of the grenade. Everything seemed to slow down, and he felt closed off from the world, as though swimming underwater. Off balance, he lifted his gear and climbed up the stairs, bracing himself like a drunk. The men in the tower had either jumped or been blown out of the 15-foot diameter circle. 2 machine guns still rested in their mounts, and a pair of shoes lay incongruously on the floor. The Reaper almost had him when it jumped into the tower. But this was no Kurian-operated killing machine, owner and avatar seasoned by long years of psychic symbiosis. The man in the unknown tank pulling the wires of his puppet was an apprentice, not a master, and the Reaper tumbled as it landed. A whirlwind stroke by the cat caught it across the neck. The head wasn't severed, but the central spinal cord was. The Reaper dropped to the ground, helpless. Its black teeth bit impotently at its own extruded syringe tongue. Valentine ignored it, unhooking one of the strap ends of the demolition charge. He flipped open the satchel charge and pulled both starter fuses from the top. Valentine spun like an Olympic hammer thrower with a single strap held in his hand and sent the bricks of plastic explosive arcing off toward the lined-up boxcars. They may have been easier to guard packed together like that, but they made an unmissable target for Valentine's explosives. He heard the thunk of the charge bouncing off a wooden boxcar's roof. Valentine dropped behind the yard-thick concrete wall of the guard tower.
Why would the general use wood for his boxcars? Of course, metal would be too hot in the sun. You'd cook the men in the tanks inside. But wood has disadvantages as well.
He picked up one of the white phosphorus grenades and covered his ears and nostrils against what was coming. With debris still in the air, Valentine pulled the pin and released the safety handle on the grenade. He pitched the hissing grenade into the destruction in the center of the boxcars. Shots from the hangar's few guards whipped through the air around him, and Valentine dropped back down before they could improve their aim. He continued to throw as fast as he could pull pins, and he saw the first grenades explode. The phosphorus bombs scattered burning white particles into the splintered wood all around it. fires devoured paint and wood in half a dozen places. Valentine heard the sound of footsteps at the bottom of the spiral staircase and sent his last grenade bouncing down the metal stairs. He turned on the pilot light of the flamethrower and came up over the edge of the parapet with the nozzle pointed at the boxcars. Valentine loosed a long stream of fiery rain on the sentries aiming their guns at him among the line of boxcars nearest the tower, painting the roofs with orange and yellow flame. The jellied gasoline consumed paint and wood, splattering and running down the sides and filling the train hangar with black smoke. Fire, the most ancient of terror weapons, was as effective on the Twisted Cross as on the Golden Ones. The boiling flames silenced the shots from the men around the cars. The Twisted Cross guards ran for their lives, some dropping their weapons as they escaped flame and smoke. Looking down from his concrete nest, Valentine exulted at the havoc wreaked below. No wonder Allie enjoyed lighting fires. The results were spectacular. The flamethrower ceased its napalm ejaculation, empty of everything but harmless compressed air. Valentine dropped it and moved to one of the machine guns. With precise movements, he opened the ammunition box mounted on the side of the gun and slapped home the belt in the receiver. With gritted teeth, Valentine pulled back the bolt and fired a burst at a group of guards running toward the boxcars. Crouching, he concentrated on keeping anyone from fighting the fires now vigorously burning among the boxcars. He could feel the roaring heat almost painfully on his skin from 30 feet away. Nothing mattered but keeping those boxcars alight and the fire growing. Two thin, nude figures staggered out from the cars on shaky legs, arms waving in front of them. Valentine cut them down with the .50 caliber and fired a burst into the cabin of a train engine being backed into the hangar to tow out some of the cars. Peppered by bullets strong enough to pierce the thin metal walls of their locomotive, the engineers jumped out of the engine and ran. Another nude Twisted Cross operator crawled from the wreckage, burned on his hands and feet. Valentine fired until the pale form ceased twitching. Valentine looked over the side and saw automatic rifles pointed up at him. He pulled back his head, not fast enough. A bullet grazed hot across his skin, and he registered a hard tap, as if a doctor had taken his reflex hammer to the ridge of bone just below Valentine's eye, and then a second later, the pain hit.
My God, I'm shot.
Not quite believing yet, he put a hand to his face, tracing the heat and feeling open skin with his fingertip. The bullet had torn a furrow up his face from his chin to the corner of his eye. The burn that lasted a few seconds was just practice for what came next as his nerves revved up. It was like a white-hot poker held to his face. He felt himself scream, but there was just a ringing in his ears, lightning in his eyes, as he viewed the world through a glittering curtain of diamonds. Concentrating like a drunk trying to get his house key into a lock, Valentine picked up the shotgun, went to the stairs, and fired blindly down the spiral staircase. Blood poured out of his face, dripped onto the storm cloud-colored concrete and the metal stairs going down. It fell across his chest like warm rain. An apple dropped from the sky and into his concrete treehouse. No, not an apple, a grenade. There was nothing to do but jump. He launched himself out of the tower to land hard on the surface below and run toward the darkness outside the hangar. Running had never been so easy. He hardly felt his feet touch the ground. Though there was no one around, someone managed to kick Valentine in his left leg as he ran. No matter, the foot on that side wasn't working that well anyway. He could hop into the darkness. But the darkness could not wait. It came rushing at him, greeting him in its comforting embrace, like a long-lost love.
It'll be all right, Molly.
Valentine found himself lost in a strange new tunnel he had somehow floated into, an ever-lengthening passage of closing mists.
If you can't walk, I'll carry you.
He found the strength to turn his head, the darkness having decided to put him gently on the ground. He could see campfires in the distance. The fires burned brightly, melding into a single fire like the sun coming up. The fire was what counted. The fire was all that mattered. Too bad he was too tired to remember why. David Valentine's body fought a hard war against waking up. Every time consciousness charged up the hill, his exhausted, pained body held the line and at the last moment sent consciousness tumbling back into the darkness of oblivion. It tried to return when he was picked up and carried from where he fell, and tried again when he was placed on a table. A bright light in his face and surgical tape over his cheek brought other battles. Later, on a hospital bed, consciousness launched a series of sneak attacks. He had vague dreams of speaking to Captain Lahav, then to his father. Death never arrived to relieve his body from its war against the pain, so Valentine eventually awoke. He was disoriented. For some reason, he wanted more than anything to know how long it had been since he'd been taken. As he spun back to the awful, real world, he reached up, but some kind of restraint frustrated his first instinct to touch his face. In fact, he couldn't even turn his body. The whole left side of his face throbbed in pain, and he felt a tired, empty nausea. There was cold dampness between his legs, as well as a warm, sticky, solid presence in his undergarments. His left leg was missing its pant leg, though the rest of his clothes were still on. The pain was too much to deal with, so he sank back into a groggy sleep. He did not sleep deeply enough. A woman eventually cut away the rest of his clothes and cleaned him up, a surprisingly agonizing process, though she handled him as gently as if he were a baby. When they changed the dressing on his face, under the care of a man not nearly so gentle, it hurt like the bullet cutting through his flesh a second time. He passed out again, unfortunately for only a minute. He came round while they were applying more searing iodine and another dressing. The hours ticked by, and Valentine tried playing games with the pain, offering the pain 30 minutes of agony for just 5 minutes of relief, but pain would not agree to his terms. He dropped into a fitful doze and came out of it a little further at a shake of his shoulder.
Would you like some water?
The man stood over his bed in a lab coat.
Yes, please.
There were more sensations now. The pain, always the pain, but he could also taste the air, and something about it told him he was underground. The man brought the cup lower, and Valentine sucked cool water down through a surgical tubing straw.
He can talk. That's good enough. Bring him.
Through the mists, Valentine felt himself being lifted, carried down a hall to another room. They sat him up in a tube steel chair with a hard wooden seat, the kind of chair that's been sitting in a neat row with five others just like it in some assistant principal's office since the school was built. They handcuffed his hands behind his back, which amused him.
I'm too weak to crawl, let alone fight.
When they moved his leg to handcuff his ankle to one of the chair legs, the pain became so bad that the warm urine flooded his pants. It felt like he was pissing nitric acid.
Oh, Christ. He pissed himself.
So what?
Valentine's head lolled, and he looked at the pale green tiles on the floor. He tried to remember if he had ever seen such small tiles, so evenly laid out, when he again slipped into unconsciousness. Later, he had to wait. It felt like days, but perhaps it was only hours. Valentine's consciousness strengthened, and the haze began to fade. He realized that he desperately wanted to live, even if it was only for a few more hours. He wondered if they were just going to shoot him, or if they had a more elaborate end in store. They gave him more water. He was able to drink it, though it hurt his face to do so. The room was uninteresting, not even a desk or another chair decorated it. The little green tiles went from the floor about one-third of the way up the wall. From there on up, it was unrelieved and undecorated concrete, marked only by a swirl or two of the mason's smoother. He smelled chalk somewhere, and tried to remember if there was a chalkboard in the room from when he was brought in. The lone door to the room was also behind it, and he heard people passing in the hall at intervals.
When Valentine heard a set of heavy steps in the hall, something inside him told him, this is it. He tried to steel his mind, even if his body felt like worn-out rubber. But his mind was a slave to his body. Intellect prostrated itself before the pain and fatigue just when he needed his wits most. The door opened, and he was able to turn his head enough, despite the pain in his cheek, to see two tall grogs enter. They were golden ones, dressed in black leather robes cut like a double-breasted trench coat of the old world and shiny as a beetle's back. One stood to his right, the other to his left. Their fawn-colored hair was shorn down to stubble. A dried-up husk of a man walked around in front of him. His skin had the waxy look of a cancer patient in the last stages of the disease. His lips chapped. Vigorous dark hair grew out from a widow's peak on his forehead and was brushed straight back across his head. His eyes could have been pale blue or pale green, depending on the opinion of the person looking into them. He wore a simple rust-colored uniform and a Sam Brown belt very similar to Valentine's own. Red tabs with golden reverse swastikas marked his collar. He wore no tunic, sidearm, or decorations.
One of the best things about living so long is that you get to see all the mistakes historians make, talking about something they don't really know. For example, the only history widely read since 2022 is that wretched pamphlet called Fallen Gods by that would-be Margaret Bourke White named Costos. She says the first of the new doors to Kerr were opened in Haiti in the 18th century. She only missed by about 1,000 years. How do I know? I was there. My eyes have looked on Charlemagne, young man. Kerr had a door open in the Dark Ages, but they were not dark times for me. Oh, no. During the Inquisition, we managed to get another open in Spain.
The general walked around behind Valentine and wheeled a cart into view. On it was his sword, his fighting claws, his little glow bulb, and a few other personal effects.
So you joined long ago. What did they offer you for betraying a whole world?
A price no wisdom can buy. Time.
So you feed?
Yes. Long, long ago, I was given a gift. A revelation of biblical proportions, you might say. For my service, the scientists taught me how to achieve immortality.
An immortality others pay the price for.
Don't cows, hogs, chickens pay the price for your life?
Not the same thing.
That's where you and so many others are wrong. Cows and so on are eaten because they're tasty, certainly. But more important, because they aren't developed enough to keep themselves from being eaten. Mankind took a great leap forward when it learned to keep livestock, putting it ahead of all other creatures on the earth, with a few bizarre exceptions, like those honeypot ants that keep aphids. We were once no better than the cows, but we developed, and the cows didn't. The cows pay the price. And we are better for it.
Why are we talking about this?
When you get to be my age, when you've seen people come and go over not just generations or centuries, but millennia, you become a good judge of men. In my days as a monk, before my awakening, I didn't think much of the human herd. No spark, no imagination and misunderstanding, even the simple concepts we tried to teach. As I've aged, I found it harder and harder to suffer fools. Most people aren't much better than cattle. They've just inherited more complex stimulus response routines. When you see men making the same mistakes over and over and over again, you lose empathy and acknowledge only utility. That's what I tried to tell Kant when I lived in Prussia.
Valentine could hear someone outside the door asking for a message to be delivered to the general and his aide accepting it.
I think you are above the herd, a valuable piece of human capital. You too have been given gifts by the Life Weavers. You have a talent that I need badly. I'd like to have you on my side rather than dead and in some grog's stomach. If you found a tarnished bar of gold in the road, would you shine it up? Or would you grind it up and toss it to the winds? I'm in a position to offer you what amounts to eternal life, a chance to grow your talent instead of wasting it.
How can you have an opinion of me if you don't know me?
When someone gets the better of me, I want to learn how they did it. I've done a little research, asked a few questions. A skilled man asked you some questions while you recovered. You were right at the Eagle's Wings brand, out on those forsaken grassy dunes. Before that, you were a promising officer, until you were sacrificed by an ambitious superior trying to keep his record clean. Yes, I have sources right in Southern Command. There are people you work for who want to live forever.
You know me, then. Who are you?
Someone like you. A reader. A leader. More of a realist, but you are young, and idealism is the asylum of the young.
I'm sorry you escaped the asylum.
I was, before my personal enlightenment, a monk of the Dark Ages. One of those depressing, chanting celibates who claimed to be keeping culture alive after the fall of Western Rome, but were in fact dreaming up new ways to take advantage of the gullible. I was something of a historian, and I found, hovering on the edges of certain ancient tracts, pieces of a larger story. I convinced my superiors to let me go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land and beyond. I ended up going far beyond anything my order expected of me. I found the ruins of the Kurian city of Brass in Central Asia, and met a smooth-skinned Chinaman who claimed to be 2,000 years old. Thus began my education in the arts of Kerr. Later they sought me out, but the Chinaman, old Zhao, he was my savior in a way. When I got my first infusion of vital aura, I was old and sick. You have to experience, I can't put it in words. Where there had been weakness, there was new strength. I'd forgotten what the flush of youth was. It is the finest feeling in the world, and the opportunities it opened. I could live my life all over again. I lived dozens of lives all over again. The Golden Horde knew me. I saw the Turks come and fade. I rode with Cossacks as the Grand Armée retreated from Moscow. I invested and let time work for me over generations. My wealth brought power and influence, which I put to the bidding of Kerr. I owned prime ministers and generals, diplomats and writers. Have you ever heard of Major League Baseball? Owners of teams used to buy, sell, and trade their players in an effort to get a team that would win something called the pennant. I was doing the same on a global scale, slowly and patiently. That is the great advantage of the Kurian scientist's immortality, Valentine. It gives you the luxury of patience.
Valentine looked at the dried-up old general. If anyone ever looked old and sick, except for his lush band of hair, it was the former monk.
Where did you get the Twisted Cross?
The general touched the reversed swastika on his collar tab.
That is an older symbol, a token of special status of those who are courted as a friend of Kerr. You can find it on artifacts from prehistory, almost the whole world over. I chose it to symbolize a reawakening of the old open alliance between Earth and Kerr, men and their old gods, men with the vision not just to accommodate the new order, but to shape it for their own purposes as well.
So, you're on a longer leash than most. It's still a leash.
Kerr needs me desperately to do their fighting for them. They are too busy running their dominions, feuding and scheming amongst themselves. Now that they have won so much, they no longer want to risk their precious reapers fighting with the pockets that are left. You've been troublesome in your obstinacy, unwilling to admit the war is over, like starving Japanese soldiers in an island bunker.
Valentine felt very tired and began to wonder if he would remain conscious for the rest of the interview, or interrogation, or inquisition.
General, I'm the one in handcuffs here. What's next for me?
You have a choice. A choice that you deserve given your abilities and manifest intelligence, albeit talents wasted in the unrewarding service of the ungrateful. I am not just speaking of the pathetic life weavers either. I am referring to your so-called brethren who stay at home while you risk your life to protect their chicken-hearted existence. I will not insult you by asking you to join me. You need not say yes. All you have to do is ask for another week's life, and then another, and then another. I will show you visions, introduce you to possibilities that will fire your imagination, your belly, your loins. Someday you may be given touchstones and have knowledge at your disposal that Aristotle couldn't have dreamed of. The rewards are literally endless. Which shall it be, son? The pistol or another week's life? What'll it be, cat? Die defending the herd or feed off it?
Valentine, hurt and tired, found an answer in his pain. Faces flashed through his memory. He saw Molly, the Carlsons, Sutton, the generous pig farmer, Linda, who'd been Mrs. Poulos for a few hours, and the squalling baby from the rig yard, Donna and her armoire-building son, the young Groggs gambling with human children around the well of Steiner's little enclave, Anka and the Golden Ones, Jocelyn Hendricks. Who would be sacrificed for whom? His voice was strong this time.
Shoot me, Judas.
Pointless end to the tale of the Valentines. You'll find your Golgotha lonely.
How lonely is your bunker, General?
Blood began to run out from under Valentine's bandage.
You had defeated me in battle? Well, defeated the men I trusted to fight my battles, which may mean the same thing. But that is a question for the philosophers. But what is a delay to me? Do you think you have really harmed me? Do you? Your pathetic little gesture was spittle in a hurricane. I can afford to think in terms of thousands of years. That is why this base is being built, not for one campaign in Nebraska, but for control of a continent. It takes years to select, grow, and train a fighting pair. I began this project before you were born, and have seen it through setbacks worse than the fire you started. The science of Kerr and my leadership has proven this system works. Men can control Reapers, Reapers who fight like soldiers without the weaknesses and desires of the Kurian from which they sprang. First principles, my son. I proved that I can do it with one. And if I can make one, I can make 1,000. And if I can make 1,000...
The door opened again, and another shorn Golden One in the leather uniform of the bodyguard entered, almost dragging the protesting aide. The arrival said something to the other two in their own tongue.
I'm sorry, sir. There seems to be a disturbance outside in the grog pen. We should go to the emergency shelter at once.
Valentine looked at the new arrivals, and his heart leapt.
Very well.
Valentine tried to stand, drawing the general's eye.
That may be true, sir, from a logical point of view. But I think someone's gonna have to pick up where you left off. It appears you fucked with the wrong species.
What?
The angry Titan picked up the general, swung him at the shocked aide. Valentine's chair fell over in the struggle. He could still see the unique sight of a man being beaten to death with another man used as the murder weapon. With 6 blows, Anka reduced both the general and his aide to bloody pulp. The general proved to be a poor choice of club. He began to fall apart after the 3rd swing. The bodyguard Groggs shrank away from the twitching corpses as though the general might rise again in demonic fury. But it was just reflex of muscle and broken bone making wet sounds against the floor. The bodyguards exchanged a few tremulous words with Anka and then embraced him.
You do not look yourself, my David. Let me help you.
The bear-like face hovered over his. As the world slipped, Valentine tried to stay conscious.
Back. Feel the pain. Smell the blood. Hear the gunfire. There's gunfire.
What did you say to the bodyguards?
If you do nothing, all is forgiven. It is a little more poetic in my tongue. I hope this does not hurt you further.
The Grog's arc of muscle at his arms and shoulders tensed, and the handcuffs snapped in two.
The door opened, and Alessa Duvalier stood silhouetted in the frame, encased in Twisted Cross assault armor. The gear made her look a little absurd, like a turtle in too big a shell. She held a rifle to her shoulder, covering the hallway, and her naked, blood-smeared sword stuck blade up in her waistband. A sweat-soaked headband kept flame-colored hair out of wild and hungry eyes.
No time for kiss and tell, boys! Heat's on!
Valentine wondered if he were in some wild dream brought on by loss of blood.
Allie, what are you doing here?
She reversed the magazine in her gun, quickly substituting the full one for the empty one taped to it.
I'm milking a male ostrich. What does it look like, Val? I'm taking point for your pointy-eared friend.
Anka scooped Valentine up in his arms and followed the female cat out the door and down the hall. At an intersection ahead, Valentine saw another golden one with a machine gun at his hip, spraying the corridor with fire. They turned at the corner opposite to where the grog was firing, and Valentine got a brief glimpse of a corridor littered with bodies. Valentine felt himself being carried up some stairs, thinking that perhaps it wasn't so bad to be partnered with a mentally disordered woman, sometimes. Then he passed out.
The hardest part was figuring out where you were.
It was the next day, and Valentine lay in his hammock in some thick woods on the Missouri River, well south of the Twisted Cross base. Anka was sleeping soundly, Valentine's PPD cradled in his arms. Valentine sipped some willow leaf tea to ease the pain. According to Duvalier, he had the blackest black eyes she had ever seen.
I caused a little trouble with the column that hit the Eagle's wings, but I mostly wanted to learn where their base was. It was just a matter of getting into camp and keeping my ears open. The stunts you pull are the type of thing only bears are stupid enough to try. I'd just as soon stay out of the way of bullets, thank you very much. Not that I don't admire your balls.
She kissed the bandage over the left side of his cheek.
Maybe I can introduce you to the twins and their big brother when I can walk again.
Dream on, Valentine. So I go to the rendezvous and wait. And naturally, you don't show. So I leave a note and come hunting around the south end of Omaha. I pretty much mapped out the base, got an idea of the numbers the Twisted Cross had, and found out that oversized perimeter wasn't too well guarded. The general was planning for the future, I suppose, but his present couldn't do the job. So one day I'm checking out the west side of the wall, and I see this ugly ape trying to move through the brush, real sneaky-like, but making more noise than a bulldozer in a bottle factory. I'm about to do him in from ambush when I see this ugly drum-fed gun in his hands. It's just too much of a coincidence for there to be two of those in Nebraska. So I stick my blade to his throat and start asking questions.
Pull.
Anka opened an eye and snorted, but he didn't disagree.
Turns out, you've disappeared into the camp. They heard an explosion from a mile off, but then you were MIA the next day. He sent his buddy off for reinforcements and had just about decided to try to bust down the main gate to go looking for you when I showed up. That night, I went into the cave and acted like a cat instead of a one-man army. Please make note of that, Valentine. Just looking and listening and hearing what was being talked about. It turned out that you were in the basement medical center below this train hangar. I saw the general return from Omaha with what was left of his force after his Reapers mysteriously started dropping in the middle of the assault on the Grogs. He said something about wanting to meet the man they captured. And I knew you were still alive. I also found out you were going to be interrogated the next day. I got back to your big friend here, and he has 100 armed-to-the-ears Grogs wanting Twisted Cross blood. And you. And then more blood.
The big man came to our aid after all. He hid a few pistols and grenades in the food going to the golden ones the general had hostage on the base. It was not much, but it got them out of their pen.
I told him to start tearing the place down. After that, it was just a matter of sneaking in with your uncle over there and waiting for our chance to get you and the general both.
What happened at the base?
They still had a lot of firepower. There were losses. It was really two rescue missions, a little one for you and a big one for the Grogs still on the base. I don't think we'll have to worry about the Twisted Cross for a while. They don't have many of those Reapers left. Maybe they can put the operation back together, but It'll take some time. Their underground is intact. We couldn't even get near that cave of theirs. We'll need to get bear teams up here to blow that.
Hong Ka yawned, showing off his tusk-like teeth.
Ha! Not if the Golden Ones had anything to do with it. Whatever we built, we know how to destroy. Even now we use the great construction machines to build a cairn for our dead. On top of the Twisted Cross bunker, of course.
Old horse, I think the balance of gratitude has shifted back in your favor. Now I am in your debt.
The Grog's eyes were closing in his dozing, so Anka settled for the human gesture of shaking his head.
I told you there could be no talk of debts between brothers, my David. I always wanted to see the wider world.
We could learn from you, too. That heart root could be grown on every farm in the Ozarks. Wherever people are, there's moisture and, fertilizer. The idea might take some getting used to, though.
I have pieces of spore pod in my pack. No Golden One travels without it. This I can do.
What about it, Allie? Shall we go home?
You need to rest a little. Why do you always have to rush things?
'Cause life is short. Thank God.
She furrowed her eyebrows at him and went back to rebandaging his leg. He felt sleep coming on him again, and he looked over at Anka. He wondered what would have happened if the cat and the grog had not shown up. His conscience pained him more than his face. Did they rescue him from a quick death or endless life? He remembered the knot in his stomach, fearing his life had run its course. His words had been brave enough, but they were just words, stiffened by pain. When he felt the cold barrel of the pistol at the back of his head, what would have been his choice? A question for the philosophers, as the general said. 8 weeks later, in the rich colors of autumn in the Ozarks, Valentine limped right into an ambush. Of course, since he saw the men waiting and watching, it could hardly be called an ambush, but the young wolves were clearly proud of their work. Valentine, Anka, and Duvalier put up their hands.
Where the hell you think you're going, Groglicker?
The leader of the close fire team squinted at them from under woolly eyebrows. Valentine would have handled the ambush differently were he in charge, letting the far fire team make contact and keeping the close team hidden to provide a nasty surprise in case things got hostile. Duvalier stepped forward.
My code name is Smoke. This is my partner, Ghost. Verification November 503. Take us to the nearest post. We're coming in with a priority report for Southern Command.
Oh, is that so? Well, cats or no, we'll have to put you under guard. So unload your weapons and sling them, and we'll oblige you right quick. What's that with you, a prisoner? I don't think I've ever seen a grog like that before. Where'd you capture long legs?
That's not a prisoner. He's my brother.
One of the patrol turned to his sergeant.
Bales, Bales. What was his old man thinking? I've heard of a guy being desperate, but there are some things that just ain't right.
The wolves, pointing their weapons away from the three, gathered around their charges, positioned to guard as well as to guide. The hunters turned and headed home. Vampire Earth, Book 2, Choice of the Cat, Part 2, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2004, Eric E. Frisch. Published by arrangement with Trident Media Group, LLC. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Jeff Baker, Karen Carbone, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Katrina Van Dyne, Colleen Delaney, James Konacek, Danny Gavigan, Johan Detweiler, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Daniel Stevens, Michael Glenn, Tony Nam, Terrence Aselford, and Mort Shelby. Book adapted for graphic audio and directed by Ken Jackson. Dialogue editing and sound design by Temeskin Wubna. Additional music by Brian Patton, Nathaniel Perry, Dan Sondak, and Johan Detweiler. produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Vampire Earth, be sure to look for Night Angel Trilogy by Brett Weeks and the Vata's War series by Elizabeth Moon, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll also find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts.
Available now in Graphic
Audio. In post-nuclear America, Rourke learns of a secret attack by neo-fascist commandos that could cripple the new free world.
We got problems, John. Annie and I have been going through the printouts that were all piled up there in the middle of the basement for them to burn. There's a reference to an SS commando unit. It's coming ashore on Molokai in less than half an hour if they're on schedule. They couldn't have been alerted to what was going on here, so they should still be coming.
It's starting again, isn't it? Everything like before. Are people crazy?
We won't let them be crazy this time.
With the fate of Hawaii in the balance, he marshals his SEAL and TAC teams for a counterattack.
Oh, what the hell do we do now? It's more than we thought, huh?
Well, this should be fun.
Fire at will! Fire at will!
But despite the godlike power of John Rourke, the evil of Nazism claws its way back from the brink of destruction.
I heard. As bad as they say?
Worse, I'd imagine, since we don't have a final body count yet. At least 83 dead children so far, and about 15 adults.
John Rourke will find himself pushed to the very edge and beyond.
You want me to be the same damn good guy you always were? For what? Where's your wealth? Where's your power? Where's your happiness? Faithful to some bitch lying in a damn coma?
She's your mother, boy. Don't talk that way. Don't you ever.
Right makes right. There we agree.
Even living legends make mistakes. Don't miss The Survivalist number 23, Call to Battle, in Graphic Audio.
God forgive me. I killed my own son.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.